All right, we'll call case number 12-20214, Tagora versus United States. Mr. Neuer. I'm almost inclined to ask the government, in light of the number of exemptions that have evidently been granted, how they can possibly claim that there's no ground for an exemption when there we have dozens of people sitting behind us who are probably wearing kirpans.
May it please the court, Scott Neuer for the plaintiff appellant, Kavaljeet Tagore.
Please turn off any cell phones or communication devices that you have. They interrupt our argument.
The issue before this court is whether the district court contravened Federal Rule Civil Procedure 56 as construed by the United States Supreme Court in Reeves by granting summary judgment to the IRS and FPS on Ms. Tagore's Title VII and RFRA religious accommodation claims. In light of this court's recent holding in Musa Sadeh versus Texas Department of Criminal Justice, the evidence, when viewed in the light most favorable to Ms. Tagore, clearly establishes that she had a sincere practice of wearing a kirpan with an edge longer than 2.5 inches. Additionally, the evidence below conclusively establishes, and the government effectively concedes on appeal, that it could have accommodated Ms. Tagore's practice without undue hardship and could have satisfied any compelling interest through a less restrictive means. Therefore, Ms. Tagore respectfully submits that the district court summary judgment must be reversed and summary judgment rendered in her favor. Given the density of the factual record, I would like to highlight 5 undisputed facts that mandate reversal of the district court. First, Ms. Tagore was born a Sikh, has practiced Sikhism her entire life, and became an Amritdhari, or initiated Sikh, in April of 2005, and in the 5-year period since then, has always worn the 5 Sikh articles of faith, including a kirpan whose edge exceeds 2.5 inches in length. Second, as an IRS federal agent, Ms. Tagore was charged with investigating civil and criminal violations of federal law. Third, the IRS and FPS banned Ms. Tagore from the federal buildings in Houston, the IRS offices, and from private taxpayer offices for 9.5 months, and then terminated her employment without offering her any accommodation. Fourth, FPS and IRS permit numerous secular knives whose blades exceed 2.5 inches, including construction tools, box cutters, and cake knives, into the IRS offices. And fifth, neither the IRS or FPS ever offered Ms. Tagore any accommodation of her religious practice. Let me turn, Your Honor.
Well, let me start off with a couple of preliminary things. Number one, the parties were sparring back and forth about amended FPS regulations. Do those moot the case?
Your Honor, unfortunately, they do not. Ms. Tagore sincerely believes, with no pun intended, that they would. However, the government has taken the position that they don't moot the case because they still contend that Ms. Tagore did not have a sincere religious belief in wearing a 2.5-inch kirpan.
And do you know who granted the permission to all of these community members to attend the argument today?
Your Honor, I do not, and nor do I know that any of the members in the courtroom here today who are of the Sikh faith are carrying kirpans that exceed 2.5 inches in length. I have no knowledge.
The only reason I ask is that nobody bothered to inform the court that this large audience would be coming until we got word that would you please break so everyone could be seated in the courtroom, and the marshals were concerned. So I'm inferring that somebody granted an exception, but it was not the court. And I want the government to explain to us how, if we can have 50 or 60 members of the community here, assuming that they do wear kirpans, that that just doesn't disprove their case altogether. But
well, Your Honor, and the record does indicate numerous examples of where federal agencies and federal institutions, including the White House, that is in the record, have granted an exception.
Well, I only saw 3 referred to in Judge Lake's opinion.
But there, yes, Your Honor, the White House granted an exception for a Sikh to enter the White House for a conference there. There is also evidence that Judge Rosenbaum, former Chief Judge Rosenbaum of the United States District Court for Minnesota, granted a full waiver, for Ajay Singh Khalsa, a Sikh lawyer in Minnesota, to enter all of the federal courthouses without any restrictions whatsoever on his 3-inch kirpan. There was additionally evidence that the FBI, which allowed an applicant to come into the New Jersey federal building with a kirpan that exceeded 3 inches. So the practice has clearly been established, and I would note, Your Honor, because
those exceptions that you're pointing, we've got a complexity of issues in this case. Unless I'm wrong, the case law on the Title VII aspect is almost the opposite to the case law on RFRA. In other words, the de minimis standard equaling undue hardship might be very favorable to the ruling below on the Title VII, but might be not at all dispositive on RFRA. So I've got a little bit of a problem of sort of a sweeping analysis saying these five factors compel. Really, the analysis has to be separate. Then second, my second question related to that is, you know, keeping the two issues separate unless you don't think that they are, is I think I just heard you say that the only reason the amended exemption doesn't control this situation, and in for RFRA we look at particularized situations, is because the government persists in its belief that your client doesn't have a sincere belief. Right, so that would just be that first prima facie showing. It wouldn't go to the Atkins balancing. Am I right or wrong?
Your Honor, there are several issues that you've raised in your question. Let me first address what one of the components of your question, which is, and goes back to Judge Jones's question about whether this is in fact a new policy. The document that I provided to the court this morning, the admissions made by the government, show that the government admitted in response to admission number 10, that appears on page 8 and 9, that exceptions and exemptions could be granted by facility security committees of the buildings, meaning each of the individual federal buildings had these FSCs.
Yeah.
They admitted below that there was an exemption and an exception policy in place back then. The government has, in fact, in its January the 11th letter to this court, does not claim that this is a new policy. They simply say that these are new
procedures. Well, the IRS tried to get a security waiver, right? It's the FBS that said no.
With all due respect, Your Honor, the IRS was equally adamant that she could not be given any security waiver at all. What they did was her supervisor said to her, if you want to try and come in with this kirpan, you need to request a security waiver. She did make that request over and over. IRS refused to give her the security waiver. But let me take your second, the other component of your question with respect to undue hardship. I agree that the RFRA standard of compelling interest and least restrictive means is the highest standard under constitutional and statutory law. It is more stringent than the Title VII standard. But with respect to the Title VII standard, the government's claim is the same with respect to compelling interest and undue hardship. Meaning the government says to this court, and they said to the district court, that 18 U.S.C. 930, the undue hardship is 18 U.S.C. 930. And they say that that provides for a categorical prohibition against any non-work-related blade that exceeds 2.5 inches. Now, the government has effectively conceded away that position because the new procedures state very clearly, and they stated in the admissions, that exceptions and exemptions can be given to that so-called categorical prohibition. We submit that there is no undue hardship here.
Let me ask you the question here, though, because your client has never agreed to a 2.5-inch kirpan, and there is nothing in the record that says that she would not start wearing a 6-inch or even a 12-inch kirpan, if those are possible, at some time in the future. And so I see the limit on your argument being whatever a sincerely devout Sikh believer considers is the proper length.
With all due respect,
is there no limit?
No, Your Honor, I believe it is case-specific. I believe both RFRA and Title VII make it case-specific. We're talking here about a federal agent who had passed a security clearance.
I don't care about that. I'm asking about the – you are not confining your argument to a 3-inch kirpan. She, in fact, wears a 3.5-inch, does she not?
If you look at the
– yes or no?
It's a little bit over 3 inches. It's not 3.5 inches.
Okay. And the most that her experts were taught, her friends, her experts, and so on, were saying 3 inches because state law regards things as 3 inches. But I'm asking you, how can we grant an exception that, according to you, has no limit except the sincere belief of the believer.
Well,
we're talking about a weapon that is inherently violative of something to protect other people's security.
Well, Your Honor, let me start by saying that even assuming her kirpan was 6 inches or 9 inches and would clearly perhaps constitute a dangerous weapon under 18 U.S.C. 930, that's only the first hurdle for the government. Then you get to D1 and D3.
I understand what you're saying, but so basically you are saying that there is no limit. So the next person we'll have is the snake handler who says I have to have snakes in my pockets all the time, even though they may pose a danger to others. And I'm not in any way trying to question the force or the value of this belief system, but and Gonzalez is a Ocentro is a very strong opinion for religious believers. But I am wondering if you are apparently totally unwilling to say that there is any limit with regard to the potential, the actual dangerousness of the kirpan.
Well, Your Honor, obviously I am counsel for Ms. Tagore on a very fact-specific case, and RFRA and Title VII, the courts have held, both this court and the Supreme Court have said that these cases must come down to fact-specific inquiries. Based on the facts of this record, Ms. Tagore is a federal agent authorized by law to engage in the investigations of criminal law, violations of criminal and civil law.
And that, of course, you know, I think the IRS does make a very good point. I know it's clearly relevant on Title VII. I'm not as sure on RFRA. Very good point that you can't send her into corporate offices to do audits if they know the part of the Sikh religion is wearing. You just don't send a federal agent to do an audit armed, ordinarily, in any way, much less with a sword, whether it's for religious purposes or otherwise. But that bears on Title VII.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, the government has conceded in our appeal, which they didn't concede below, that 18 U.S.C. 930 doesn't apply to private taxpayer offices. Ms. Tagore.
I know it doesn't apply, but just from the standpoint of we're the IRS, and we're here to help you. And, oh, by the way, we're wearing a sword.
Well,
they wouldn't allow them to take hunting knives, would they?
Well, absolutely, under the statute, under 18 U.S.C. 930.
I'm not talking about 930. I'm just talking about interpersonal relationships between the power of the federal government and the relative subservience and lack of power of the taxpayer. It's a bad symbol, and it's also probably not even allowed.
Again, Your Honor, the evidence in this case is very clear that Ms. Tagore and most Sikhs who are Amritdhari wear the kirpan sheathed underneath their clothing. It's not at all visible. There's no evidence in the record that Ms. Tagore ever brandished this kirpan, that she ever posed a threat to anyone. In fact, the evidence is to the contrary. So the fact that there may be fears, and that's what motivated the government here. The government was acting strictly based on fear and irrationality, because they had no evidence that she was, in fact, a threat.
But we have case law, obviously the balance that's being searched for here, some limiting principle, and maybe you will just answer that, well, in RFRA, there could be no precedential value to any other government or sensitive or school building because it's always individualized. That may be your answer. If it is, what about our case law that's applying RFRA in prison context? We have this tension in the law that we have to defer to security concerns, and yet that seems inherently against a strict scrutiny analysis. What you have a thought on, say, obviously the case I'm thinking about is our Mayfield decision. You have prisoners that say they are Odinists, and therefore they need stones, rocks in prison. And even in that context, well, go ahead. Do you distinguish or rely on Mayfield?
Your Honor, I do agree with the court that it is very fact-specific. I do not believe that this court need announce any global rule with respect to kirpans. That's not what's before this court. This is a federal employee with a security clearance who works in a federal building.
Okay. Now, with related to that, do you distinguish or do you rely on Mayfield? Do you remember the Mayfield decision?
Well, I'm generally familiar with it, Your Honor.
The problem is there, we did remand. In other words, we remanded for that balanced Atkins inquiry. And so maybe that's appropriate here because there, like here, we suddenly are told there's a pilot new program. There's an exemption. The government says it's not new. You say it is new.
No, I say it's not new. The government even says that the policy didn't change, simply the procedures changed. The government says in its admissions that they had an exemption and exception procedure in place back in 2005. They just decided not to give Ms. Tagore the exception or the exemption. And in fact, if you look at Exhibit X to our summary judgment motion, you will see that the FPS recommended that Ms. Tagore be allowed to come in to the Leland building with her kirpan in excess of 2.5 inches, meaning they recommended a security waiver, but the facility security committee of the Leland building denied it. So let me just address the other issue with the penological.
Are you answering a question? Or are
yes.
you gonna, are
yes.
you sure?
Yes.
All right.
I was going to say, Your Honor, there is a significant distinction between the prison context and this context. There is a great deal of deference owed to prison officials under RLIUPA, the sister statute to RFRA. This court has said so over and over again.
Thank you. You have time for rebuttal, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Sturgill.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Lowell Sturgill from the Department of Justice, representing the government. And I should begin by answering Judge Jones's question at the very beginning of the oral argument, and that is that the government has no knowledge about how the individuals who were escorted into the building today were allowed to come in. And Mr. Newar has told us that he doesn't know whether or not.
What is our clerk's office? I sent a message out.
And again, Mr. Newar doesn't know, he's honest enough to say, he doesn't know whether they're carrying kirpans of any particular length or not. So the fact that they're in the courtroom, I think, tells you very little. Also, as we've explained in our briefs and letter, the Federal Protective Service, which is a defendant in this case, does not control security for federal courthouses. That's controlled by the Marshals Service. And the Marshals Service, of course, will respond as appropriate to whatever circumstances are brought to it. And the other thing I would note is that the individuals today, there's a marshal in the courtroom. And as we mentioned in certain of our letters, Ms. Tagore would be a federal employee, and she would be basically walking around the federal building, the Leland building where she worked, with an unescorted pass. So even if the case were that these individuals had kirpans, they're supervised, they're escorted, and Ms. Tagore would not be. I'd like to go ahead and address some of the points that came up during
Why don't you start off with the new regulations, because I don't understand. Were she on the payroll today and exhausting administrative remedies, wouldn't she be allowed to continue employment?
We don't know, and this is sort of a complicated answer. The first thing is that any exemption would be granted only if a person could demonstrate a right under a statute like RFRA. Well, we know, at least as it stands right now, the district court has held that she doesn't have a valid RFRA claim, among other reasons because she couldn't prove a prima facie case.
But you conceded that on appeal, didn't you?
No. We've taken the position that the district court was correct in finding that she did not.
I know, but you barely argued it.
We substantially argued it in our brief. And we've, based on our own testimony, we can talk about that if you like.
Do you argue it, but do you have any case that we've issued that's affirmed a finding of no prima facie belief as to the sincerity? Any case that we've ever affirmed a summary judgment finding that the individual didn't have a sincere belief in the exercise of religion?
Well, I don't, but if you're suggesting that summary judgment is never appropriate on that prong of
RFRA, I'm not suggesting anything. I'm asking, do you have any authority?
I haven't looked, to tell you the truth, because I don't think I don't think it matters. I mean, we don't need that case. I've been litigating these cases for 25 years. It's a very unusual case. You have a plaintiff who, in her deposition testimony, in this case, is asked whether she has a personal belief that she needs to wear a kirpan of more than 2.5 inches, and she says no. And not only but no, but she explains it. And she explains it multiple times. And this is where I was going to respond to Judge Jones's question. You have to look at the district court's opinion lays this out, page 2239 of the record, which is in the appellant's record excerpts. And if I could, I'd just like to read from the opinion. The question on page 27 of the court's opinion, would you consider wearing a shorter blade on the kirpan of less than 2.5 inches? There's an objection, and then the answer is, first of all, to me, a kirpan is a full kirpan. In my mind, I don't differentiate as to how much is the edge, i.e. the blade, and how much is the handle. So this question was irrelevant to her. Well, the clear implication there is if she had a Kirpon that was 6 inches long, but it had only a 2-inch blade, that would be fine. Now, if that wasn't clear enough, the government's counsel then gave her another chance to elaborate on this question again. If you turn to page 28 of the district court's opinion, USCA 52240, government's counsel, do you have a personal belief of whether you could wear a Kirpon of less than 2.5 inches? At that time, no. That means before she talked to her attorneys. And then we clarified, as you sit here today, do you have this belief here today? And then she repeats the same answer she gave before. In my mind, to me, a Kirpon is a totality. I don't look at it as to how much is the edge or how much is not. Now, what the district court said is the perfectly rational thing, is that you have a case where the plaintiff is asked the key question in the case in her deposition testimony, and she says no. It would be like a tort case where the plaintiff at trial is asked whether the defendant injured her, and the plaintiff says no. What does the court do? The court is going to credit her own testimony and find that she can't and doesn't have a personal belief that she needs this. That's what our brief explains, and that's the first reason why both plaintiffs' Title VII and RFRA claims fail.
Well, extrapolating from a practitioner's unwillingness to assert a global mandatory view as to an article of faith, she's saying, you know, I think the whole point of this law and the reason you don't have a case where we've ever affirmed that no reasonable jury could believe that her belief as to this article of faith is sincere is because we never, judicial shyness, we never subject to scrutiny and say, well, she didn't in this case assert that the worldwide belief distinguishes between 2.5 and 3 inches.
There are cases in which courts find that plaintiffs, well, the first thing the court has to do is not determine what the sincerity, whether she's sincere or not, but figure out what is she claiming, what is her claim. In Henderson versus Kennedy, the D.C. Circuit did this same kind of analysis. People who claimed they had a need to wear T-shirts on the mall, and the Court of Appeals said, well, can't you wear T-shirts? Couldn't you satisfy your religion by wearing T-shirts? With selling T-shirts off the mall, and they said, well, yeah.
You're familiar with the Mayfield case, correct?
Very vaguely, but please, I'll do the best I can.
It seems inconsistent with the prima facie case, but I don't remember if that was litigated. That's where prisoners assert a very tenuous belief in sort of an Odinist belief they need runestones. And obviously in that case, we immediately got past whether we were going to second guess that belief structure. We moved right to what I think is personally, a more difficult analysis, more appropriate analysis, which is the least restrictive means aspect of this case.
Well, you know, typically this first part of RFRA in Title VII is not really at issue, because what happens is a plaintiff comes into court and says, this is my religious belief, and unless there's some obvious reason why the government or the court would question the sincerity, then you move on to the second part.
Well, I'm so sorry, but just one other point on the religious belief. The court, July 22nd summary judgment opinion, found that Secretary Geithner did dispute plaintiff's contention that her sincere religion. Okay, correct. I misread. Sorry about that.
I don't know if we.
I think we've covered out. The Ninth Circuit decision in Chima might be a good one for you to comment on, but move to wherever you thought you needed to go.
Well, Chima is a good place to go next, because in that case, as you recall, there was a question of whether a student could come into a school with a kirpon, and the Ninth Circuit said yes, but only if the kirpon was sewn into the sheath. Well, in this case, what the record shows is the IRS asked the plaintiff if she would be willing to wear a kirpon sewn in a sheath, and her lawyer responded no. And the record shows the reason why that is because for plaintiff and for the other believers of Sikh religion, the kirpon has to be able to be used as a weapon. That's the whole point of it. It has to be able to be used in defense of self or others. So that was one accommodation that was.
Letter response from her attorney, I don't believe the IRS said no because we need to be able to use it as a weapon. Is that what you're saying?
No, the IRS didn't say that.
No, the letter response from her attorney when the IRS.
No.
So
other parts of the record say that.
Other parts say that Ms. DeGore said she needed to be able to use this as a weapon. I find that very difficult to
believe. I believe her EEOC testimony said that. She said that she's explaining what is the significance of the kirpan and explaining that this is a, supposed for Sikhs, it's a defensive weapon. It's the point of it is to be able to, you know, use it as a defense of others or mainly for others, to be a helpful kind of thing for others. But again, and Mr. Khalsa, I believe, this plaintiff's expert, said the same thing when he was explaining what the significance of it.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about how 930D3 fits into this equation? Because the statute on dangerous weapons in federal facilities has this exception for uses incident to hunting or other lawful purpose, and their argument, not irrationally, is that this is a lawful purpose.
Well, the there's one district court opinion on this question, the Cruz-Bancroft opinion, which is cited in our brief. And what Cruz-Bancroft said is that the FPS reasonably construes the statute. This part of the statute is limited to work-related items. And it said that for two reasons. First of all, it makes sense. The whole point of a federal employee going into a building is they go there to work. So if you're talking about the purpose in this context, the purpose it makes sense to say it has to be work-related. But second, and this sort of, I think, adverts to something Judge Jones was saying before the earlier part of the argument, is that the Cruz-Bancroft said to say otherwise would make the exception too broad, because then really if it's just saying, if she could wear it outside the building, she could wear it inside the building.
Well, why would hunting be in there?
Plaintiffs have never argued anything about hunting and tried to make any kind of argument based.
I didn't say that they had, but I mean, it seems to me that how is hunting, normally you would say other lawful purpose has something to do with the scope of it might have something to do with hunting. And so what is there about hunting that makes it, entitles a person to an exception, and how does that relate to other lawful purpose?
The district court did address this hunting question, and what it said was that applies on federal lands where you have a federal office building on a federal land where hunting is permissible, like
no,
in a
I don't buy that, just because the language of the statute doesn't say. I mean, it would have been very easy for Congress to carve out hunting permits on federal land where hunting is permitted, but so that's why I just find it a little odd.
Well, there isn't any legislative history, and I think, again, the government is entitled, FPS is entitled to deference and is reasonable reading to the statute, and I think it's reasonable to say that hunting, as FPS has concluded, only applies if you're on, like, a wildlife area where hunting is routine and permitted, that maybe that would be an exception. But again, I think even if hunting is, even if that's not right, I don't know how that leads to requiring an exception for plaintiff here, because nobody can hunt in this building, and if that were not the case, she could bring in a gun. Why does it depend on what the item is? So you could use the same argument to justify a gun or something else. So again, I think that's what the district court said about that, and it makes sense.
Well, let me ask you about and again, let's assume that the courthouse in Houston were the Mickey Leland facility, and at Christmas time we have a courthouse-wide party where all the different units within the courthouse have food, and there's a lot of barbecue and ham and ergo carving knives, and people have been bringing more than 3-inch bladed carving knives into that courthouse as long as I recall. Is that a lawful purpose?
Well, first of all, again, the Federal Protective Service doesn't control
security. I know that. Okay. I already accomplished.
Putting that aside, what the record shows is Mr. Carmody, who was the who testified at the EEO hearing.
These are not cake knives.
I'm sorry, the carving knives?
Carving knives, okay, for the barbecue and the ham.
Well, the record doesn't say anything about carving knives, but I think you can, my assumption would be that they should be treated the same way as cake knives.
So you're saying they would not be within the scope of 930D3.
That would be the conclusion I would draw. But again, unless perhaps it was in a cafeteria, Well, Mr. Comody said that there was a cake knife in the building, he was aware of it, he would take it out. The other thing that's in the record is that,
He doesn't know what a cake knife is then.
The other thing in the record is that even if, the second problem with that is that the record shows that people can't bring those, even like scissors or whatever can be brought in, have in the building, you can't bring it through the security screening process. So even if a cake knife could be allowed in the building, you couldn't bring it in through security, which is what plaintiff is seeking to do with her kirpan. And the reason is explained in Mr. Muccino's declaration and Mr. Camotti's testimony. The reason is that would require guards to make subjective judgments about what's sharp enough or what's not too sharp. And again, the Federal Protective Service has 14,000 contract guards across 900 buildings, and it has to have rules that its contract guards can apply. And again, the concern is if they're allowed to make subjective, required to make subjective judgments.
Well, what do you do about the fact that this lady did pass a background check?
That might be relevant under RFRA in determining whether she should be granted an exception. But again,
do we have any record development as to the assertion just made that, in fact, the original suggestion was that she get a waiver? Do we have any idea why it was she was denied the waiver in this record?
What happened was her mainline IRS supervisor saw the situation, and he reacted completely reasonably. This relates to the Title VII question. He didn't say, you're fired. He said, well, gee, why don't you work at home while we try to figure out an answer? And one of the things he did then was make some suggestions. And one was, and he sent her a letter. So would you be willing to wear your kirpan sewn in a sheath, wear a dull blade?
I agree. The Title VII analysis is quite different in whether or not it would be an undue hardship on the IRS to allow her to have flex time at home or not. Our law is different in that respect. But if we look just at the RFRA aspect of this, do we have any record development as to why it was the original waiver request was denied?
The record shows that originally Mr. Carmody denied the request because the kirpan was longer than the 2.5 inches mentioned in the statute. Then what happened over time is the IRS sent this letter to plaintiff suggesting some alternatives that might conceivably be less restrictive, but in fact the government has never agreed that they would be. But plaintiff even rejected those. And then the plaintiff's main argument was that she should be allowed to bring this in because it's dulled. It's a dulled kirpan. That's why she should get a security waiver. So then at that point, the Federal Protective Service specifically addressed that suggestion, and it decided that would undermine the government's compelling interest for the reasons we've just discussed. It would require these 14,000 contract security.
And the specific reason is it would be a dangerous weapon as defined in 930.
Right.
And did they reach the exceptions? Did they say this doesn't?
No.
No, I don't think they did, right?
Not at the time, because again, well, this is the way these things happen, and this is the way this happened in this case. Plaintiff comes in with a non-compliant knife. She says, I want a religious exception. So what the FPS decides is, well, is this barred by the statute? Is there any reason to believe she should be granted an exception? And she hadn't at that point suggested there were any other alternatives, and the FPS hadn't thought of any, so it said no. Then as the case developed, some of these alternatives came out that were individualized to her, and they were addressed duly by the Federal Protective Service, and then you have in the record why the government and the Federal Protective Service.
It seems to me what happened, and it's understandable, is that the analysis given to her was focused on it being a dangerous weapon and it fitting one of those exceptions literally. No one ever gave it the characteristic of being an article of faith, perhaps because it was disbelieved that it was for her an article of faith. And therefore, it never slipped into the framework of RFRA, where the government had to be vastly more exhaustive of any possible accommodation.
Well, first of all, it's not the case that she was ever denied entry because of her religion. There's no support for that in the record. So I don't agree to that part of it. But then again, over time, as the case was litigated, the question of whether RFRA exceptions could be granted to this plaintiff did come out, and you have a record on it, and you have the government's explanation for why the accommodations she suggested would undermine the government's compelling interest. And I think that's all you need.
And then my problem with that is this piece of paper that they put on our bench this morning, which I assume you have a copy of, that talks about exceptions and exemptions.
Well, that's actually part of the record. We submitted that to the court in December.
Well, I mean, this to me makes it evident that they are both exceptions and exemptions are available.
The policy is new, first of all, to answer the question. Policy is new because... That is new because it adopts new procedures by which the Federal Protective Service will evaluate these requests for exemptions.
But it's your position she got them anyway, even though the policy wasn't articulated quite this way?
Essentially, that's right.
That's
as the case wound its way through, the government did what it would have done under this policy.
So this is just a typical government deal. Sure, we're abiding by the law. Sure, exemptions are possible, but, if you actually apply, you'll never get one.
Not at all, Your Honor. First of all, again, she hasn't even alleged, for reasons we've talked about, that she has a religious need to have a cure pond of longer than 2.5 inches.
I wasn't quite at senior moment as I thought. You did say that the court did not need to rule on the extent of her sincere belief in order to resolve the case, because you were going to move to the compelling interest test. And, you know, reading Ocentro over, it seems to me you have to make an individual specific determination about compelling need.
And as we've discussed, that has been done.
No, what's the government's compelling security need vis-a-vis this individual?
If she's allowed to bring this knife into the building,
and everybody.
There's an additional dangerous weapon that has been brought into a federal building and could be used to seriously injure a federal employee or a visitor. Now the question is, does she get an exception? My time is out. Does she get an exception because it's dull? And you have all the explanations for in the record that you need to address the RFRA claim and affirm on each of those suggestions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Neuer, if your plaintiff succeeds in this case, is another person going to sue TSA immediately?
Your Honor, I think the court knows from the Gonzalez case that the Supreme Court has rejected explicitly the slippery slope argument that counsel just tried to articulate.
But what's your answer to that question?
My answer to the question is I don't know, and there's no evidence in the record that there's a mass wave of Sikhs looking to try and breach the
fortress.
Well,
not mass wave. The question to you is just, what's your position intellectually, since you've studied this, as to whether Ms. DeGore wanting to get on a plane would have precisely the arguments you're asserting to us? Can you think of any principled reason the court wouldn't be obliged to oblige her?
Well, again, Your Honor, this is a different context. The TSA is a different context. We're talking about a federal employee under a specific statute, 18 U.S.C. 930. The airline statutes are completely different. They have different...
And the prison statutes are different?
Absolutely.
And the White House is different?
The White House is subject to 18 U.S.C. 930, according to, at least as far as I know, there's nothing specific to the White House. Mm-hmm. But let me just address real quickly, Your Honor, this issue of Title VII, since you seem to have a concern about a lower standard under Title VII. The standard with respect to undue hardship is that the government has to plead and prove, it has to demonstrate. The government has made no effort to prove. There's no evidence in the record that she poses any undue hardship here with respect to a dulled kirpan that is worn sheathed inside of her never demonstrated.
I mean, I was suggesting to you, and I believe it wasn't my view, it was Judge Lake's view, that it would impose a hardship on fellow employees because you cannot send an armed IRS agent armed with anything out to audit a civilian's business.
But 18 U.S.C., Your Honor, 930 doesn't apply to private taxpayer offices.
I know that, but just as a matter of good business sense and community relations and all that, you know what the Internet would say, armed IRS agents heading for the 7-Eleven.
Your Honor, again...
And leave aside the nuance that it's a religious article and all that. So just play along with me. Judge Lake did refer to that, didn't he?
I don't recall Judge Lake referring to the private taxpayer offices, but if he did...
But think of your limiting principle that you just articulated to us. Dulled she. But you've never said that, one, in the record, it's not that clear when you look at it, that it's dulled. That's a very difficult concept to...
You have not...
It is in the record.
It
is in the record.
It is in the record.
Absolutely.
Oh, I know. I know we've looked at it. Don't assume we think it's dulled, number one.
Then are they going to investigate her underwear every day to see whether it's dulled?
It's not in her underwear, Your Honor. She wears it on a strap suspended from her shoulder.
But when you said she, I thought it was very clear that she was given legal advice that it couldn't be sewn in. So how can you assure us that it would always be sheathed? Is that part? Why do you say that?
That is her testimony, that she wears the kirpan.
Is the testimony that they are never unsheathed?
The only time she testified that she unsheathes the kirpan is when she is in engaging in some sort of religious act. Always outside, the testimony is she wears the kirpan underneath her shirt, strapped onto her shoulder in a sheath.
Now, your opposing counsel mentioned a record site that she'd said it needed to be used as a weapon. Do you dispute that?
Absolutely. And let me also say that the opposing counsel has selectively quoted the deposition transcript of Ms. Tagore in 2010. She was asked after the part that Mr. Sturgill quoted to the court, she was asked this question: would you, as you sit here today, consider wearing a kirpan in totality of less than two and a half inches? And her answer was, I would wear the kirpan that I have right now, and anything less than what I'm wearing or what I wore the second time is not a kirpan to me. Ms. Tagore has been consistent since 2005 that anything less than three inches of the blade would not be a kirpan.
Judge Lake was very emphatic in noting something that she said that happened after she consulted with counsel.
No, Your Honor, there was an objection that was made in the deposition that Mr. Sturgill just read, in which I objected to the question with respect to her beliefs. The question was based on the fact that when she was asked in June of 2005 by the IRS, would you agree to wear a dulled kirpan? And her answer was, absolutely. The lawyer for the Sikh Coalition responded she would wear a dulled kirpan, and her kirpan was already dulled. So when the government says she rejected this accommodation, it's flatly untrue. She was willing to agree to wear a dulled kirpan. Now, I want to talk to Your Honor about the issue of least restrictive means. There were less restrictive means here. They could have, one, granted her the security waiver that they now admit in their new procedures that they have. Two, they could have given her the continuation of the FlexiPlace program. The evidence in the record establishes that the IRS had this telecommute program in place in 2005 and 2006 in which revenue agents worked from home. And they transported to the IRS office, to the private taxpayer offices, and they rarely came into the federal buildings. That is in the record. They could have continued that program in place for her, but they decided, the record shows, that because of her temperament, now that she was in the Sikh religion, they were going to refuse to do that. There is evidence of religious animus in the record that shows that they denied her this less restrictive means based on religious animus.
Well, that's a very strong statement to finish with in rebuttal argument. What is the exact record evidence that you're pointing to of religious animus?
There is quoted in our brief. It's also quoted
It's
a December 2005 email in which the EEO director states, is quoted as stating that we would be hard-pressed to remove her from FlexiPlace since we've done it this long. And it goes on to state that two of her supervisors, Keith Jones and Sergio Arellano, her second-line supervisor, are concerned now about her temperament now that she is in the Sikh religion. That is quoted in the brief. It is quoted in the district court.
And what did Judge Lake say about that?
Judge Lake did not credit that testimony. I believe Judge Lake said something to the effect that he believed that it was hearsay and it couldn't be credited. Obviously, on summary judgment, all inferences are to be drawn in favor of Ms. Tagore.
It's hearsay. All right, sir, you've used up your time. We appreciate the careful attention that all parties have given to this case, and we'll be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.